Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Vern Fonts. I chair the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. With me is Cindy Burgess, who is our rules coordinator, and I think the person who put that statement in the testimony. And it is an issue for us, and we wanted to make sure you understood that as an issue. If you want further elaboration, I would have to defer to Ms. Burgess on that question. She is an attorney.
I think we need further elaboration, really, for the moment, to set the setting. So, to tell us in practical sense what you're trying, what you feel you need to do here, and then we can overlay that with Cindy's comments on whether you think it's ex post facto or not.
Now we're talking about Senate Bill
211.
211.
Right.
Let me go back here to Senate Bill 211.
It's 214 and 211 combined. Now.
They are now combined, and I am just aware of that.
Were, no, the testimony was on Senate Bill 211.
Page 2 of your testimony.
Senate Bill 211 testimony.
The Senate Bill 211 really was designed by us and with the agreement of the Department of Corrections to close what we thought of as a loophole in the statute that allowed persons to be released up to 6 months early in those circumstances when the board did not set, for a variety of reasons, a release date. We might choose not to set a release date, for example, in a case in which the crime was so oblivious to the value of human life that we felt the person needed to spend as much time in the institution as possible. In that case, for example, on a 20-year sentence, they might spend, they would stay to their good time date. And we would say, we do not set a parole date. You will remain here 13 years and 8 months. And our intent was that they would remain 13 years and 8 months. And when that date then was not set, the Department of Corrections could release them up to 6 months prior to the 13 years and 8 months. Now, you received some testimony, as I recall, from an inmate group objecting to this bill. I don't know that they raised the issue, the ex post facto issue, in that discussion or not. But what they're saying, I think, in this case, or they would be saying, or the issue is, look, we've had this, now you're taking it away from us. And those of us who have been in here a long time and have this kind of a no parole date situation could have gotten out 6 months earlier. And you are, with this piece of legislation, requiring us to stay longer than we would ordinarily have remained. I think that's basically what it comes down to. Is that correct, Cindy?
Yes.
So by your refusal to set a parole date in a conscious way to keep people longer,
that's correct.
Then they have been taking advantage of that by getting out, by the corrections department letting them out
6 months.
6 months ahead of time.
Now there are, that date. Madam Chair and members of the committee, there are other circumstances in which that good time date is changed, and we may set a date, and the department may, for a variety of reasons, not a variety of reasons, but because of what's called extrameritorious good time, reset the good time date to a date earlier than our parole release date. For example, our parole release date could be today. We set that 8 years ago. The offender has been in the institution and he has earned extrameritorious good time, and his date was recalculated to yesterday. And the department could have released him 6 months prior to yesterday. And we're saying in this case, no, you can't do that. It could only be 2 days prior to yesterday.
As opposed to six months.
That's right. And again,
so the
I
difference
think
is they can only release him 2 days early as
right.
opposed to six months early.
If this is implemented, that's correct. It would be 2 days, would apply to everyone. That six-month loophole would be taken away.
Madam Chair?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Cindy could give me some comfort then on the constitutional aspects of ex post facto, of changing what they had regarded as a right, denying that after the fact, just since you acknowledge that it's not a slam dunk.
Senator Cohen, Senator Shoemaker, I'm not sure that I can give you...
Excuse me, you need to get your name...
Oh, this is Cindy Burgess, a staff member of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. I'm not sure that I can give you comfort. The Court of Appeals just passed State Williams versus Board of Parole, just decided that within the last year, where they said even our administrative rules, if they result in an adverse action toward an inmate, can be seen as ex post facto laws. The court is saying that the board actually imposes punishment, or they don't impose the punishment, but they decide how much punishment a person will get. And we had been arguing, no, we release people from punishment. So I'm not sure that I can give you comfort. I think that the statute does need amending, perhaps not the six-month part, but the part that talks about changing the meritorious good time date so that there won't be confusion about who has the responsibility to release people when.
I think what I hear you saying is that as the bill stands, if it were to be challenged as ex post facto, you would think the odds are that it would be held to be ex post facto by our Court of Appeals. I think that's what I hear you saying.
Yes.
I'm not very comfortable with that, Madam Chair.
Well, I guess I didn't hear the last interchange. I was talking to Senator Bunn, but...
Well, let me say it again. I asked the question of Cindy that if we were to pass the bill in its present form and were to be challenged as an unconstitutional ex post facto law, that the odds are that the Court of Appeals would uphold that challenge. It would find that indeed it is an ex post facto law, and her response was yes. In other words, her opinion is that this is probably an ex post facto unconstitutional law.
Okay, then I guess I'm going to say in that case, I see conflict between the staff to the board and the board sitting before us here.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and I guess I want to say that I don't know, you know, I don't know what that means. Maybe we don't do anything and we go back to just pass 214.1 as it is. I mean, I guess at some point the staff and the board just go to the back of the room and decide what they want to do about that.
If I may.
Yeah.
Certainly, I think given this set of circumstances, we need to look at this again. And we need to talk about what we need to do here. And I think Ms. Burgess has indicated there's another way to address the issue without raising the ex post facto issue. And we need to talk about that. And I think probably would like to talk with counsel about that as well.
Okay, well,
see if there's some way we can rescue this and address this issue.
Okay, the chair is getting exceedingly concerned with things that are set at work session and that have been sort of sitting there for a long time, and then we decide to work them and move them, and then we're going to be running out of time very soon. So I just want to raise that as an issue. I don't care one way or another, except that I do think we need to have those kinds of things clarified. And I guess that leaves me in a circumstance of saying, going back to 214, which is also on the docket today, do you want to go ahead and do 214 as it stands separately? I guess I want to hear from the board on that to see what you think about that one.
Well, Madam Chair, or members of the committee, we gave it to you separately.
Yeah. Because of this issue, no.
And it was not, I mean, we didn't blend these two together.
Oh, I know. I just want to know whether you want 214. There was And you may not get 214 either on the face of it, but that's okay.
Well, if we don't get it, we don't get it. But I think I would prefer to proceed,
okay,
recognizing that we need to work more on 211, and 211 may not happen, and 214 may not happen, and that's
good.
That's the process.
Yeah. I'm trying to withdraw my motion.
Okay. Then we'll set that one over, and let's talk about 214. There may be reservations in terms of the straight 214 by itself. At least I heard some initially in hearing. So we're back to 214 as it stands, with a dash one amendment offered.
And Madam Chair, there are hand engrossed amendments to that bill in the file as well.
Okay. So committee members want pleasure of the committee on Senate Bill 214.
A motion?
I'm happy to take any motion that anybody wants to put forward. You do need to move the dash one amendments, I think, right? We're changing prisoners to offenders, and let's hear from Vern on the dash one language, or Ingrid, I guess. What have we done with dash one language?
Madam Chair, the changes represented with the amendments require substantial compliance with the conditions of probation, parole, rather than exemplary behavior. And that terminology was considered ambiguous. The dash one amendments also delete section two of the bill on pages one and two. And it's my understanding that the board simply felt that the existing language was satisfactory with respect to
the section two. We could live with
it. So I guess I'd ask Senator Springer, does deletion of section two take care of your concerns?
I don't have any problems with that.
Okay. Senator Hill.
No.
Okay. Senator Bunn, you want to
move the dash one amendment?
Okay. Senator Bunn, move 214-1. Objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Okay. Move the bill.
Good. Senator Bunn is moving Senate Bill 214 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Bunn.
Aye.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Get Senator Bunn to do that. Okay. Next in line, we're taking 215. Ingrid. Senate Bill 215.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this also comes from the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. It does two things. It permits psychologists as well as psychiatrists to perform dangerous offender examinations for the purpose of determining if a prisoner is eligible for release from prison. Secondly, it transfers responsibility from the Oregon State Hospital to the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision for performing and funding those examinations. Both the Department of Human Resources and the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision support the measure. It has a Ways and Means referral.
Okay. This one has no amendments offered.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Shoemaker.
Did the psychiatrist have any difficulty with this bill?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, we did not hear from them. However, they psychologists are authorized to perform the initial examination at the request of the court to determine whether a person is a dangerous offender. So this would conform to that same practice.
Motion?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I move the Bill to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senate Bill 215, Senator Bunn has moved with a due pass recommendation to Ways and Means, unamended. Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Bunn.
Aye.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Sir? Votes aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Senate Bill 216.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this also comes from the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. You should have a hand-engrossed version of 216, which includes LC amendments designated 216-1. This bill extends the authority of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision to grant early release to persons sentenced under sentencing guidelines and persons sentenced to serve gun minimums who are suffering from severe medical conditions, including terminal illnesses. The Board already has that authority with respect to pre-guidelines prisoners, and this would extend it to post-guidelines prisoners and gun minimum prisoners. It has what is described as a minimal fiscal impact, and the Department of Corrections also testified in support of it.
Senator Shoemaker.
Amendments.
Do we have amendments that seem to make some...
Section 3.
Exclude, remove the terminal illness reference, or am I not?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, yes, the board decided that the term severe medical condition was more appropriate than the language terminal illness, because a terminal illness may or may not amount to a severe condition at any given time.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bunn.
If you want a discussion on the bill, I'm...
Sure do.
I'm willing to support the change. I don't... Maybe there is a clear definition of a severe medical condition, but without that, I would want to leave terminal illness in or forget the bill. No.
Senator Springer.
I'm not sure what severe medical condition means, and I guess I'm thinking if we had someone who's got a... this kind of problem, and I'm not sure what we're contemplating. This person presumably is going to have a care need for continuing health care, and I guess this came from the Board of Parole, but are these people, albeit perhaps not a large group, basically going to find themselves out in the community without any way to get health care except through public assistance, which I guess they're receiving health care now through the correction system, but what provision is there going to be for health care for these people if they're on the outside? Any?
Madam Chair, if I recall the testimony from the witness on this bill, the illustration used was Alzheimer's.
My recollection is that it's very few cases. I don't think there's any major worry that it's abused, but I think that since, in essence, what they're dealing with are these terminal cases, and it's very few, we should leave that in the statute so it's clear what we're doing. It may be perception, but I think what I heard them testify to was a very small number of cases, and those were cases where the person didn't live very long after they were out. And I think that the original wording was preferable.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shoemaker.
As those of us on the Health Insurance Committee are aware from yesterday's hearing, the phrase terminal illness is in itself not clear. Does that mean fatal disease? Does that mean a disease from which you were about to die? In the law we're considering in that committee, we're proposing to define it as a disease from which you were about to die, but I don't think there's any such definition in any other part of the statutes. So terminal illness, standing alone, doesn't really tell us very much. Persons suffering from inoperable cancer, but perhaps with 10 years to live, has a terminal illness. And I don't think that's what they're intending.
Senator Bunn.
Well, a severe medical condition, I think you could argue if you had a leg amputated, it could be a severe medical condition. And whichever term we use, in essence, we're leaving it to their discretion, and since we're not defining either, I don't think we're necessarily taking away the right from them to do what they're wanting by leaving terminal illness, but I think if we have one of the two without a definition, and I don't think we need to take the time to make a definition, but if we don't define it, I believe that terminal illness without a definition is closer to what we're trying to get to.
Yeah, I would remind folks, I think, in the original 216, line 10, sub B, says a severe medical condition including terminal illness. It doesn't say it has to be terminal illness.
No.
And I guess that's another piece there. You know, it, if you really read what the original 216 came in at.
That's the reason, Madam Chair, because I don't think you could classify Alzheimer's as a terminal illness.
Right.
And in fact, Madam Chair, the present law reads just a severe medical condition, which is, I guess, as you pointed out. So if we want to leave well enough alone, we exclude the reference to terminal illness.
Well, Madam Chair, as I read the bill on line 10, I realize the severe medical condition wording is there. We're simply adding including terminal illness. But, and that's fine to add that, but I don't want to take out the wording lower under the amendment that uses terminal illness. At any rate,
oh, I see.
Line 21.
Line 21. And that makes it consistent.
Mm-hmm.
For consistency, I would think they should read the same, should they not?
Well, I think that's true. Let's call up Vern again to find out whether there's a difference between 126 and 122.
I'm not sure I want to go back.
That's okay. It's our doing, isn't it?
Committee.
Well, I could wind up finding I had something here I hadn't understood that I'd put in here. I'm Vern Fotz, Chair of the Board of Parole.
We're really here to help.
Yeah. Well, we're stuck on the language here, apparently. Our intent was to try to get into, was to give us the authority to set aside the gun minimum in certain cases where there was a severe medical illness and the person clearly was one of those kinds of individuals who, for humanitarian reasons, would be moved from the institution at a date earlier than would be set by the minimum term. The gun minimum is the only minimum we cannot now set aside. And it is, as you know, a 60-month minimum, which, when good time is applied, really comes down to 40 months. So we're talking about a very short time frame here. The case that I described to you when I came originally was a case of Alzheimer's. The man had been in about 12 or 14 months. He was clearly unmanageable in the institution, and we had a gun minimum in place. And in fact, we had a 10-year, 120-month minimum, which was set aside by the board, which left us then with 40 months. He had a severe medical condition, and he had a terminal illness. He had both.
Well, not.
But Alzheimer's is a terminal illness, and it is a severe medical condition.
Well,
this may be. I don't think we need to get into this discussion. I'm sorry.
Yep.
But that was the circumstance. We could not set that minimum aside, and there was a plan to move him to a different setting that was a protected setting that would have appeared, would have been more humanitarian care for him. That could be. In any event, we wound up commuting that sentence. The other cases that we have moved, in my 4 years of experience with the board, the other people who have moved out, and they have been fewer than six, have departed this earth within a matter of days or weeks of their leaving the institution. And these are not people who are I've just lost a leg. I mean, these are seriously ill persons, severe medical condition. They might live weeks, they might live months, and they could live longer. but for humanitarian reasons, and in some cases it is a matter of the quality of care available to them, it makes sense to move them from the institution. Now, we have had in 144.122 the language severe medical condition for a long time. I'm not sure when that was implemented, but it's been, in my experience, 4 years.
122 is before guideline, pre-guidelines, and 126 is after guidelines, right. And 161, 610 is the gun minimum.
That's correct.
So in any case, we ought to, are we doing ex post facto change the
hopefully
pre-guidelines piece of language there?
Well, this is certainly in these cases to the benefit of the offender. And so in that case, it's the ex post facto issue does not.
Well, except that Senator Springer would, I think you need to try to figure out. I'm not sure that Senator Springer, I'd ask you to respond to Senator Springer's earlier question.
I'm sorry, could you restate your question, Senator Springer?
He was concerned about people being dumped out of the institutions with no medical care at all. And your comment was that it certainly is to the benefit of them, and I don't know.
Well, Chair Cohen and Senator Springer, my experience, that has never happened. The people who've left under those conditions have left because there was a resource there. Part of the reason they left is because there was a resource to provide more effectively for them than we had in the institution.
Well, I'm glad to hear that's the case. I guess I just would think most folks are going to be in indigent status.
They are. And many, many are. In some cases, it's a matter of family. In one other case I cited, it was the availability of a hospice for a person who was terminally ill with AIDS, and the hospice was available to him, provide that level of care. We were not able to act quickly enough, and he passed away before he left, but we were considering his release under 144.122. That's the kind of case we're talking about.
Okay. That's helpful. Thank you.
Yeah. I think
they're going to be in public aid anyway, whether it be in prison or be under Medicaid. The effect on the public dollar is probably not significantly different. And they will have care in either case. Probably better, though, on the outside than the inside.
Okay. What do you have the pleasure of the committee, Senator Shoemaker, on these? Senator Bunn left and said he didn't really care.
I would move the, I guess they're -1 amendments.
That's correct.
I think that's where we are, isn't it? That will exclude reference to terminal illness and will have severe medical condition be the standard for both pre- and post-guideline sentences. So I'll move those amendments.
Okay. Senator Shoemaker has moved amendments -1. Are there objections to Senator Shoemaker's amendments?
So, Madam Chair, just for discussion, so we'll stick to deleting the including terminal.
Right.
Objections to Senator Shoemaker's amendments? Hearing none.
I think Madam Chair, I would like to keep the language including terminal illness, and I just think from a practical matter, maybe Senator Bunn doesn't.
Then I think your comment is, I think that what we ought to do is including terminal illness. What's wrong with Senator Shoemaker just saying severe medical condition, including terminal illness, both in the top and in the bottom?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that you actually have terminal illness in both places. So Is that something that I hear people saying yes, and I know it's redundant, I know it's not technically correct, probably, Senator Shoemaker, but I guess it would be my recommendation that we go up to line 10 and we remove the brackets so that it will read a severe medical condition, including terminal illness. And then we come back down to line 21, and we will say, suffering from a severe medical condition, including terminal illness. And leave it in that standard set way. Are there any objections to us doing that?
No, as long as the legislative record is clear that by terminal illness we mean terminal and close to death, which is the definition that is being considered in Senate Bill 494 involving right to die legislation.
Okay. I would say that if that legislation passes with a definition of terminal illness in it, whatever that means, then this certainly the statute would
I'm not sure because it's confined to that act.
Okay.
But certainly when I'm voting for this and with the understanding that that is in fact how it's been applied, that's what I understand terminal condition to mean. Not simply a fatal